Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Emerson. I'm co-counsel for the appellant, Mr. Alan Medina. As you're aware, Mr. Medina has raised numerous issues in his opening brief, all of which I believe are meritorious. However, because I know my time is limited, I plan on addressing the first four issues. What I want to first focus briefly on is the speedy trial issue, which is explained fully in his brief, and then I'll transition to issues two through four, which address Mr. Medina's right to testify with the assistance of counsel, and I'd also like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, getting right to Mr. Medina's speedy trial claim. The issue he raised in his brief is whether under Colorado Speedy Trial Statute 18405-1, the continuance is chargeable to a defendant when his trial counsel must withdraw because of a serious health problem. Just to briefly discuss those facts, on September 10, 2007, Mr. Medina's trial counsel, Mr. Cole at the time, informed the trial court that he had to withdraw due to serious health concerns. Over Mr. Cole and Mr. Medina's objections, the trial court extended Mr. Medina's December 26, 2007 speedy trial deadline and also continued trial. In doing so, the trial court stated, and I'm just going to quote right from the trial court, from the transcript, "What I'm going to try, Mr. Medina, is I'm not going to require that you waive it. I'm going to consider it a waiver." Now, I'm not sure what that actually meant, but I will assume that what the trial court was doing was charging the continuance to Mr. Medina. And it's my contention this was error. And I believe our Supreme Court's decision in Gallagher v. District Court is the dispositive case on this issue. I'll briefly just mention that case. In Gallagher, defense counsel withdrew, and the trial court appointed a new attorney who could not try the case within the speedy trial deadline because of a scheduling conflict, essentially. Trial court found that substitute counsel's inability to do so was a continuance that should be charged to the defendant in that case. And our Supreme Court reversed and made several findings that are very important to this case. The first finding was that the continuance was not chargeable to the defendant because he had done nothing to cause the withdrawal of his attorney. The second finding was that the continuance was not necessary to protect that defendant's right to the effective assistance of counsel. There were 57 days left before trial. There was nothing in the record, apparently, that said that would not be enough time for counsel to prepare for trial. And finally, the Supreme Court held that the trial court had an affirmative duty in this case to make a reasonable attempt to find an attorney who could have tried the case prior to the speedy trial deadline. And Your Honor, what we have in Mr. Medina's case is the exact same situation. First, just like the Gallagher defendant, Mr. Medina did not cause this continuance. Obviously, it was made necessary by Mr. Cole's withdrawal, not by any affirmative act by Mr. Medina himself. And second, this is not a situation where Mr. Medina's right to the effective assistance of counsel was in jeopardy. We have 107 days in this case from speedy trial, from the date that the continuance was charged to him until the speedy trial deadline. There were 58 days in Gallagher. That's nearly twice as many days. And finally, just like the court in Gallagher, this trial court made no effort whatsoever to find counsel who could try the case within speedy. The court had a duty to do that, make a reasonable effort to do it, or to make a record of why it could not do that, and it did neither here.
You're not quarreling with the need to continue the trial?
No, there was a need to continue trial. That's correct.
Okay, so your position is that before extending speedy, the court had to make reasonable efforts to find a lawyer and a lawyer who could get the case tried by the middle of December.
That's correct, Your Honor. The necessity to continue a case doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be charged to the defendant. And there's case law, and this Gallagher case stands for that. There's also a case, People v. Duncan, I believe, that also says that as well. The statute really essentially, the way it's been interpreted, is that it needs to be due to the affirmative consent of the defendant, which we do not have in this case, some affirmative action by the defendant, which we don't have in this case. He at all times did not want to waive speedy trial. At all times he did not want to continue the case, but obviously he had to because counsel was withdrawn. And so I contend this is a violation of the speedy trial statute, and the violations, as you know, the Colorado speedy trial statute require automatic reversal and dismissal with prejudice of all charges, and that's the relief that I'm asking for on this claim, Your Honors. I want to turn now to the issues 2 through 4, if I may. I anticipate that we'll have some questions about these issues, and what I'd like to do first, Your Honor, is take 1 to 2 minutes to go over the facts, the relevant facts, because I think they're very important to the legal analysis that needs to be employed here. Then I'll discuss the Schultheis and the Nix cases, and explain why the conduct in those cases does not comport with the findings in those cases. So just turning briefly to the facts, trial began on January 2nd, 2008 in this case. It lasted 3 full days. Near the end of the second day of trial, trial counsel, who is Ms. Martin at this time, disclosed to the court her belief that Mr. Medina would testify falsely upon taking the stand. The following day, she files a motion to withdraw. It was pursuant to Colorado Rule of Professional Conduct 1.16 and 3.3. She included with her motion a sealed affidavit. Trial court denied her motion and instructed counsel to make a supplementary record in front of an ex parte proceeding before Judge Hyatt. Judge Hyatt reviewed all relevant papers, spoke to Mr. Martin, spoke to Ms. Martin and Mr. Medina, and ended up concluding that there was no evidence that he would testify falsely. He stated, and I'll just quote his ruling, "I'm not prepared to say that you're in a position where you have certainty that this is testimony that should not be presented." Now, the trial court, talking about Judge Madden now, he conducted his own hearing, ex parte hearing. He unsealed the confidential affidavit with the acquiescence of trial counsel. He talked to the parties at length, and he reached the same exact conclusion. And ultimately, what he decided was he was not privy to the conversation between counsel and the investigators. He had not been privy to the conversations between Mr. Medina and his various attorneys. And then he couldn't conclude that this was testimony that would be false. And he essentially confessed that the possibility that Mr. Medina's memory had just changed over time, or that it was always consistent and was just misunderstood by his attorneys. In spite of this, what he decided to do was to relieve trial counsel of the obligation to present the testimony, decided that she could only ask questions she felt ethically she could ask, and that then Mr. Medina would have to testify in narrative form. And that's exactly what happened, Your Honors.
Well, let me focus in on that a minute.
Sure.
Did the judge order defense counsel not to ask questions that would have gotten into the narrative, or did he simply acknowledge that that was a course of action that defense counsel might choose to take in light of her ethical concerns?
I'm not sure if I would characterize it the latter, but he certainly didn't order. He did not order. Under the circumstances, he said that she could ask those questions she felt ethically that she could ask, and then whatever she did not feel ethically comfortable asking, she could then sit down, and he would say to Mr. Medina, "Is there anything else you'd like to tell the jury?" And that's exactly what happened.
If the court, by order, didn't limit counsel's role, then why should we analyze this as a deprivation of the right to counsel rather than counsel's dereliction, which would lead to ineffective assistance analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I think this is a great question. I think that the court in this situation is the protector, is a steward of these rights, and has a duty to protect the rights of Mr. Medina. And Mr. Medina has these rights, and the court should not be endorsing an attorney relieving herself of her duty to zealously represent her client. It should not be endorsing that, should not be allowing it to happen, especially under these circumstances, which I can get to in 1 second, where we don't really have any firm certainty that this was that he was going to testify falsely. It was very speculative in this case. And if I may, I'll get into some of the case law and tell you what I believe the standards are.
Let's assume, and I think I may be anticipating Judge Johnson, let's just assume that both Ms. Martin and the trial judge, well, at least Ms. Martin was wrong in her assessment of her legal duties. Why isn't that an ineffective assistance issue, period?
Well, it may be an ineffective assistance, but that's not what we've raised in this brief. What we've raised in this brief is a violation, is the trial court's violation of his rights by not telling counsel, "This is speculative. You do not know. You need to represent your client. Get up there and represent your client. If you're not comfortable with that, then we can address that in a different situation." But this was a situation where Mr. Medina absolutely has a right to testify. He absolutely has a right to have an attorney assist him in that in testifying, and to not have the jury see him standing up there alone. And the court violated that right by not telling counsel to do her job.
Go ahead. So the court can tell an attorney, "You must ask questions of the witness."
I think in this circumstances, I would say yes, because if you look at under the case law and under the ethical rules, this was not a situation where she should be able to sit down and say, "I'm not going to represent my client." And essentially, if you look at the Schultheis case.
But what authority is there for the proposition that a court can order counsel to ask questions? What case is there that says that? I mean, isn't there a separation of powers problem there? Isn't there a problem of who's representing the defendant, the court or counsel?
Well, I'm not saying that the counsel should have said to what questions asked, but in this case, the court had a duty not to endorse counsel and to suggest that counsel could just sit down and make Mr. Medina testify in narrative form. There had, especially based on this speculative belief, there has to be more. You know, we have to set a high bar, I think, for protecting these rights and for not letting attorneys not do their duty.
So let's take a hypothetical. Let's say that this issue hasn't come up at trial, but the defendant has decided that he wants to testify in narrative form. That's how the defendant just wants to do things. And counsel agrees with that, thinks he might come across as more personable, whatever. Okay, so counsel gets on the stand, or excuse me, the client gets on the stand, and counsel says, Mr. Smith, would you please tell your story to the jury, and sits down. Now, are you saying that in that situation, the court has to jump in and go off the record, dismiss the jury, make some kind of inquiry as to whether counsel is performing her job adequately?
Well, you know, Your Honors, I'm not saying that, but it's hard to speculate because it's not really it's not this case at all. This is a case where we have an attorney who has said over and over and over again to the judge, I think my client's going to lie. And so it throws us into a completely different realm. In that situation, if a client wants to do that, and I think that the attorney may have to honor that, we don't have the same ethical situation hasn't arisen. It hasn't arisen. And it has arisen in this case because of what counsel did repeatedly, which is say, my client's going to lie. She did it on a very speculative basis. And so,
and she had two judges tell her that your client, there's no indication your client is going to lie.
Two independent judges and two ex parte proceedings who reviewed all the materials said that, correct.
And the judge who is trying the case is aware of that.
Is aware of well, the judge is one of the judges. The judge trying the case.
Correct. He's one of the judges who came to the conclusion that the client would not lie.
That's correct, yes.
Why isn't that ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, Your Honor, maybe, but that is not the issue we're raising on direct appeal. If Mr. Medina wants
How is it a Sixth Amendment violation?
Because Mr. Medina had to testify without his counsel. He was standing there up there alone in front of a jury without counsel. What Ms. Martin did in this case was she did actually present his testimony on two narrow issues. His prior convictions. So what she did was get up there and say, here's my client. He's a criminal. He's got six prior convictions, and I'm not going to represent him anymore. I'm going to sit down and make it look like he's a liar. So there may be an effective claim, but that's not what we're raising, and he's free to bring that at a later time.
What was raised below? How was the objection lodged? As I understand the record, the complaint was that there was abandonment. Was a Sixth Amendment violation raised as an objection
during trial?
Yes.
It was not Mr. Medina. And throughout the proceedings, Mr. Medina raised it on his own behalf in front of Judge Hyde and in front of Judge Madden. He said, hey, you can't make me testify in narrative form. What about my right to testify? What about my right to counsel? Ms. Martin did not do that, but of course it's hard to really, she did not do that, but it's questionable whether she's representing him at this time. He's in a difficult position. He's got an attorney who's calling him a liar. He's got an attorney who won't represent him and won't present his testimony. So I was then supposed to expect that she's also going to be steward of all his constitutional rights. I don't think that was probably the case. And so he's in a difficult position. He did do a very good job of representing himself in that situation. If you look at the record, he did say, what's happening to my rights? If you don't let me get up there, I can't say I can't tell my story. What about my story? I don't believe what this victim has said. I think he's lying, and I need to get my side out. And that's exactly what Mr. Medina has said over and over and over again.
Oh, but doesn't the actual testimony belie his claim that he couldn't get his story out? I've read the record. Seems like he got his story out pretty well on direct when he testified in narrative form. And then even on cross-examination, he was able to flesh it out even further. I mean, what did he want to say that he couldn't have, that he didn't say? How did he say something that he would have said it differently had he had a lawyer? What's the prejudice?
You know, I can't speculate on what he might have said it differently, but certainly our system, our adversary system, has it set in place so that we have defendants who are represented by counsel, and there's absolutely an advantage to that for them to have their story presented through counsel, and he was denied that. And I think there is prejudice to being made to testify in narrative form. And I'm short on time, but I'll run through a few of those prejudices. First of all, there's a sort of implicit idea that it gives the wrong impression to the jury that the attorney does not believe their client. That's first of all.
Why is that? Well, I'm not sure I agree with that. Why doesn't the jury just say, I mean, what do they know? They just know this is how they want to present their testimony. I mean, why should they draw any adverse inference from this?
I think the adverse inference comes from the fact that every other witness throughout trial, through everything they've seen on TV and everything, there's a certain process.
So every other witness needs help, but this defendant doesn't need an attorney's help. He can tell his story by himself.
Absolutely, but it stands out, and I think that allows the possibility for the jury to think that. I think it also is a situation where the prejudice is that we have someone who's not being zealously represented by their attorney. And I think that's prejudicial as well. And then finally, I think that the other problem here is we have an attorney acting as a fact finder. And that is just a serious perversion of the way our system of jurisprudence is supposed to work. And I'm out of time, so I thank you for the time, and I'll close on that. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm John Seidel, representing the people, and my number is 17633. I guess I'll do sort of follow counsel's map and talk about speedy trial first and then the other issue.
Mr. Seidel, I hate to interrupt so quickly in your oral argument.
I was doing so well.
But I'm a little more interested in this last topic we were talking about. I really want to focus on what's the constitutional right that is at issue here. And I understand that you have a difference of opinion with opposing counsel. Your briefs take the position that we're dealing with a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel as opposed to a deprivation of the right to counsel. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Should I explain?
And you know, I think I understand it from your briefs, but I guess I'm wondering about what kind of a procedural quandary that puts us in. Is it your position that the defendant preserved such a claim for appeal? That is an ineffective assistance claim.
Boy, that's a good question, and I guess neither side really addressed it.
Well, let me try to help you, if or not. We've got many Supreme Court cases that say ineffective assistance should be raised under 35C, not direct right. appeal. What would be your position if we were to reject defendant's arguments, not reach the question of whether there was harmless error here, and simply say that none of our ruling is prejudicial to any ineffective assistance claim he may bring under 35C?
I think that is defensible. One of the reasons, but I say that with a qualification. The qualification is that the whole point behind having 35C hearings is that in most cases the record is not of counsel's actions and the reasons therefore is not developed. And oftentimes there needs to be a hearing provided that the allegations are sufficient to warrant it. There needs to be a hearing to develop that. Now, in this case, arguably, the record is fairly well developed. In fact, as I read through it, I felt like it was overdeveloped. But I think that if one were to take the position that categorically there are no circumstances, including this case, where the record can be developed adequately on 35C claims, then you could do what Your Honor suggested. I'm not sure of the long-term sort of wider implications of that, because if you do that, then you have the problem of, well, anytime a counsel and defendant have this conflict over what defendant is about to do, then trial judges say, well, wait a minute, the court in such and such a case, this case, said that this is all has to be hashed out in 35C, and it's not clear to me how a trial judge would go about deciding, well, what do I do with this conflict? Do I make a record now only to have it be ignored at the appellate level? I think that if the court wanted to do that, it would have to say, set out a procedure for trial courts to follow in events, in circumstances similar to this case.
Well, is your position in this appeal that Mr. Medina did get effective assistance of counsel, or is it your position that it doesn't really matter because his narrative was as effective a mechanism of putting facts before the jury as would have been question and answer on the same subject?
Well, my position is very close to the latter one that you outlined. My position is that he suffered no, whatever counsel's conduct was, whatever its reasons, whether or not it was quote-unquote deficient performance under Strickland, defendant was not prejudiced.
Are you conceding that it was deficient?
No, not at all, but I'm just saying the part you focused on where he got, and Your Honor, Judge Jones seemed to say he got his story out rather well. In fact, in my brief, I think it was clear and coherent was the words I used. And the cases that I cited in the brief reject the idea that just because counsel doesn't ask it, non-leading sort of short answer questions, that the jury's going to find be biased against the defendant. And I agree with those cases.
Mr. Seidel, I want to get back to my question, which was whether a claim of ineffective assistance was preserved. And I want to tell you where I'm going with this. Let's assume we decide that this is cognizable as an ineffective assistance claim and that it was preserved. Now, ordinarily in a 35C, we have the Strickland test where the defendant has to show deficient performance and prejudice. Okay. I'm wondering if that framework works on direct appeal, because if the error is preserved and the defendant establishes deficient performance, that we have a constitutional violation. And usually we say, if it's preserved, it is the people's burden to show that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In other words, we have a potential here for a shifting of the burden in a pretty significant way, depending upon whether this is preserved or not, it seems to me. Or do you disagree with that? Do you think the Strickland two-prong test applies the same, whether it's direct appeal or a collateral attack?
Well, that's another area that I think if you look at Kretzinger, of all cases, which I'm not sure anybody, I guess I cited it in a different context, in a different argument, but Kretzinger said, Justice Coates said, there are some kinds of errors that to show that there's been a constitutional violation, you have to show an impact on the outcome. Strickland error is one of those. And Justice Coates said in Kretzinger, for those kinds of errors, it makes no sense to apply a harmless or a prejudice test after you determine that there has been a constitutional violation. So taking that and applying it here, it seems like what you have here is a Strickland claim, and preserved or not, the test is the same. Was there deficient performance, and was there prejudice? Now, in a collateral attack, it would be the defendant's burden to prove both prongs. In this case, I believe it is still the defendant's burden to show reversible error because it's a direct appeal. And so effectively, the test is the same here as it would be in a collateral attack. He's got to show deficient performance and prejudice. We've discussed prejudice, and it's our position that there was not ineffective assistance here. Briefly, I think we've gotten past the point where I need to say this is not a denial of counsel claim. Counsel was here and present at all times, acting as defendant's lawyers within the bounds of ethical considerations. Her conduct as counsel.
I'm not sure we're past that point. Okay. I asked you some questions of, making assumptions, but let's talk about that.
Okay.
Counsel was there in the sense that counsel was present in the courtroom, but counsel was not performing as counsel. Counsel had chosen to remain silent. What's the difference between that and counsel, say, just leaving the room when the defendant testifies? Wouldn't that be a deprivation of counsel?
I disagree with the premise that counsel was present but not acting as defendant's lawyer. If you look at Schultheis, there's this quote in there on page 12 of the opinion that says counsel's decision to call witnesses or who to call is not ineffective assistance merely because it is based in part on ethical considerations. Here, counsel made a choice, decided that the best way to proceed would be to permit defendant to testify as to his version of the events, but not aid and abet what she believed, reasonably believed, would be a lie. Nix is the same, says the same thing many times. Counsel's overarching duty of loyalty and advocacy, end quote, is, quote, limited to legitimate lawful conduct compatible with the very nature of trial as a search for truth, end quote. Counsel must take, quote, all reasonable lawful means to obtain a client's objective, but not, quote, in any way assist, close quote, in the presentation of false evidence. My suggestion is that just because counsel isn't doing what typically is done with a lot of witnesses does not by itself establish ineffective assistance, particularly where counsel has spread on the record her reasons for conducting this examination in the way she did.
Well, would your position change if we decide that counsel was wrong? Counsel did not have an ethical obligation here to refrain from asking the defendant questions about his defense. Because it seemed to me your response kind of assumed that the attorney acted consistent with the ethical obligation. So let's say we decide the attorney did not.
Well, in that case, well, first of all, we do have cases that say the lapse or failure to follow an ethical rule is not, in effect, deficient performance per se. So we have that problem to deal with. If the court says, well, she really didn't have an ethical obligation to do what she did, that doesn't mean it's deficient performance. What we have to say is, well, even if she had no ethical obligation, did the rules permit her to do what she did? And my argument is the rules absolutely did, because, and when I had to talk about the reply brief, there's a suggestion in the reply brief that, gee, all we're doing is relying on RPC 3.3, which deals only with known false testimony. Well, we're not really just relying on that particular subsection. We are relying on the comments to those rules. The comments reflect that, and then of course 3.3A3 deals with the obligation not to present false testimony, known false testimony. In that case, narrative is the approach to be followed. I don't think there's any dispute about that. Now, the comments say that the defendant, basically a defense lawyer, has an interest in excluding evidence reasonably believed to be false, and that would be comment 7. The lawyer has discretion to refuse evidence reasonably believed to be false, except in a criminal case. In that case, the lawyer cannot refuse to present testimony reasonably believed to be false. Defendant's counsel must honor the client's decision to testify. Now, that's in comment 9. But then comment 9 says, go back to comment 7. Comment 7 is the one that says, using narrative approach is appropriate, at least in the jurisdictions that require it. So Rule 3.3 permitted counsel to make a statement, I reasonably believe that my client is not going to testify truthfully. I believe, and I'm speaking as trial counsel now, I believe that the best way to proceed is for me to ask questions on things I don't think there's going to be a lie, and then allow him to present narrative testimony per these comments.
I want to challenge the logic of that, because the counsel has no ability to prohibit the defendant from testifying. I mean, counsel can recommend all she wants, but it's the defendant's right to testify. So the defendant can get up there. So when you say that the counsel is honoring the client's decision to testify by allowing him to testify in a narrative form, I guess I'm just not following. It's not hers to allow or not, seems to me.
Well, maybe my choice of words was bad. I guess what I'm saying, it was her, based on her reasonable belief, it was consistent with the rules, the ethical rules, to say, I reasonably believe he's not going to testify truthfully. Therefore, my obligation is to, obviously, I can't refuse to call him, but I don't have to participate in conduct as his lawyer, that would be unethical, that I believe would be unethical for me to do. However, I realize that he has a right to testify, so the balance is, I'll ask him the questions that I know are permissible, and I'm not, but I will ask for questions that I believe might produce a falsity. So my choice of words was bad, but...
It seems to me you're still assuming that counsel acted properly under the rule in determining that that she had an ethical problem. I mean, you keep saying it over and over.
That.
I know you believe that. I know that's your position. My hypothetical is, let's assume she's wrong. Let's assume counsel has misperceived her ethical obligations, and that because of the nature of the circumstances here and the client's testimony, that she would not be violating any ethical prohibition by presenting his testimony in question and answer form.
Well, then I think you're into the world of was there prejudice from an instance of ineffective assistance of counsel, and my argument would be there was not.
Why isn't that determination better made on a 35C hearing? I mean, all we've got is the proverbial cold record. We can't anticipate what arguments or, for that matter, even expert testimony might be offered in a 35C hearing concerning the prejudice prong.
Let me qualify what I said. Based on the arguments that were presented so far to this court, there really wasn't a strong argument of prejudice offered by the defense, because their focus was on the denial of counsel.
And structural error.
And our position is there was no denial of counsel. So if we're in ineffective assistance land and we're looking at prejudice, the only prejudice that we could see from the people's standpoint as we wrote the brief was the idea that standing up there and testifying without being asked questions would appear to be prejudicial. The cases we cited, I think, in the brief debunk that idea and refuse to assume that that is prejudicial. That being the case, the defendant got his theory of defense out. He was cross-examined on it. The trial moved forward. I'm not seeing any other form of prejudice that there could be. We did discuss in the briefs a little bit about how he felt about his lawyer later on. But, you know, my time is up, and so I guess what I would say in summary is that based on the arguments that were presented so far about prejudice, I'm not sure that a remand is necessary. But having said that, it would be consistent with the court's other Supreme Court and this court's precedents to remand for a hearing on those issues.
Thank you.
And I thank you for the extra time.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.